the coming evangelical collapse.
That means the end of evangelicalism.
I mean, my Christian heritage appears to be blowing up.
American evangelicalism, it's going down and going down hard. Sold itself out to consumerism, to the Republican Party, to various other things that had nothing to do with Christianity, and it's failed to pass on the Christian faith in any defensible form.
This is Reasonable Faith, Conversations with Dr. William Lane Craig. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Kevin Harris. Many are saying that the face of evangelical Christianity, especially in the United States, is changing rapidly. Today, we'll get some insight from Dr. Craig. Quick reminder, this podcast is available along with many other resources at reasonablefaith.org. That's reasonablefaith.org.
Dr. Craig, we've become aware of an article that's getting a lot of attention in the Christian Science Monitor, The Coming Evangelical Collapse. And the byline is that an anti-Christian chapter in Western history is about to begin, but out of the ruins, a new vitality and integrity will rise. And so this is kind of a good news, bad news article from Michael Spencer. Thought we could talk about it a little bit as it relates to church life, Christianity in the West, Christianity in the States, and where we're headed. We've spoken on evangelicalism. Let's define that quickly. By evangelical, we mean?
Well, I think we would mean someone who holds to the traditional Orthodox doctrines of Christianity that are exemplified in the great creeds of Christendom, but also someone who recognizes the importance of the personal decision of faith on the part of the individual to come into a personal relationship with God through Christ, to experience an inner spiritual renewal called regeneration or the new birth, which puts one into a saving relationship with God, and also a strong emphasis upon biblical authority as the sole rule for faith and practice as opposed to church tradition or ecclesiastical teaching. Those would be some of the emphases of evangelicalism.
That is a definition that so many of us would hold to be, you know, basically a New Testament Christian. Call it evangelical or whatever it's become necessary to differentiate among various branches and so on. What's disturbing is the first line of this article. He says, we are on the verge within 10 years of a major collapse of evangelical Christianity. Now, that'll get your attention immediately. Within two generations of evangelicalism will be a house deserted of half its occupants. Between 25 and 35% of Americans today are evangelicals. The collapse will herald the arrival of an anti-Christian chapter of the post-Christian West. Intolerance of Christianity will rise to levels many of us have not believed possible in our lifetimes, and public policy will become hostile toward evangelical Christianity, seeing it as the opponent of the common good. Well, first of all, do you agree that we really are in a post-Christian West?
Well, now, that I do think is true. I think that's very clear that we have a high consciousness of the religious plurality of our Western society today. I think the rise in consciousness of Islam has helped to promote this understanding of ourselves as a pluralistic society. This is especially evident in Canada, which is very, very pluralistic, and in Europe, and I think increasingly in the United States as well. So I do think that there is a consciousness that we do not live in a Christian society in this country anymore.
Now, he gives some reasons for why he thinks that evangelicalism, as we know it, will collapse. Number one, he says, evangelicals have identified their movement with the culture war and with political conservatism. This will prove to be a very costly mistake. Evangelicals will increasingly be seen as a threat to cultural progress. Public leaders will consider us bad for America, bad for education, bad for children, and bad for society. The evangelical investment in moral, social, and political issues has depleted our resources and exposed our weaknesses. And he gives his examples. Being against gay marriage and being rhetorically pro-life will not make up for the fact that massive majorities of evangelicals can't articulate the gospel with any coherence. Mm. We fell for the trap of believing in a cause more than the Christian faith.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's got some things there, Bill. Jerry Falwell has died. The moral majority is no longer really in existence. A lot of the aging leaders are passing the baton. And many of the recent aging leaders of the evangelical movement and so on really did put a lot of stake in the political process, political conservatism, and these various causes.
Well, that's certainly true. And yet, on the other hand, Kevin, what concerns me is the question, well, what is the alternative to standing for right to life, traditional marriage, and so forth? I don't think that we can trim our sails to fit the current political winds. It seems to me that in some cases, evangelicals have to take unpopular political stands on ethical issues. And so to say that because it will make us culturally despised and unpopular to be pro-life is no reason, it seems to me, to let one's support of pro-life causes fail. There, it seems to me, we're in a genuine dilemma. If it is true that this will make us unpopular and despised, then I fear that we have little choice but to say we must let the consequences fall where they may. We are taking a principled ethical stand on certain issues, like being pro-life or being in favor of traditional marriage. And God help us, here we stand. That I don't think we can compromise. Now, certainly that doesn't mean that we need to be in the pocket of any political party. I think it's good when Christians express their independence and may take stands on non-ethical political issues that can be issues of genuine debate. And there, perhaps, our diversity needs to be more clearly exemplified in the public square. But that first issue that he raises seems to me to be a kind of insidious attempt to get Christians to compromise their stand on important ethical issues out of a desire to be culturally approved, to be popular. And that is an appeal that we should definitely resist.
Yeah, he seems to decry the fact that we have marshaled the evangelical troops, so to speak, by scaring them and by throwing up these causes. I guess he's saying we've been kind of demagogic in that. We've got to rally the troops, we've got to raise our funds, and so we've got to tell everybody how bad it is. Well, certainly that is, but then when that booger bear is not so bad anymore, well then what once marshaled the troops no longer does it. And so we can't build our faith around causes. We should build our faith around Christ.
Well, certainly that's true. And the second part of what he said is a genuine concern, that I am deeply concerned with the superficiality that exists in the evangelical church. My colleague J.P. Moreland has called this empty selves. And he describes in his book, Love Your God With All Your Mind, the kind of church that we seem to be building in the evangelical community, a church that is filled with what he called empty selves, people who are non-reflective, who don't value the interior life of the mind, who are sensate and go for pictures and visual arts and music rather than intellectual reflection and study and careful discipleship. And I do think that J.P. is right when he says that a church which is filled with these empty selves will be a church that is impotent to resist the encroachment of secular culture and will ultimately accommodate itself to secular culture. And Moreland predicts that in the next generation, this kind of church will become its own gravedigger, because through its accommodation to secular culture, it will become indistinguishable from it. And so I do have a tremendous concern and a great fear that he may have his finger on something that is correct here in this article. But what I would say is that it is utterly incorrect, and he provides no evidence to think that this superficiality is due to a depletion of resources because of evangelical stands on traditional marriage and pro-life causes. That's just silly to think that these are related to each other. There is no trade-off here whatsoever. You can be ardently pro-life and be a reflective, intellectually engaged Christian with a profound understanding of Christian doctrine and apologetics. Indeed, I would say that those Christians who are most ardently pro-life are those who have a deep grasp of the ethical issues here and who are reflective Christians. But he is absolutely right in that we've got to somehow counter this superficiality in the evangelical church. And that is one reason that we started Reasonable Faith 2 years ago. It is the burden of this ministry to provide an intellectually credible and articulate voice for biblical Christianity in the public arena and to train Christians to be similar, articulate, and intelligent defenders of the Christian faith.
Having said that, Bill, you may like this next point that he makes. It's rather related to the end of his first point, and that is we evangelicals have failed to pass on to our young people an orthodox form of faith that can take root and survive the secular onslaught. Ironically, the billions of dollars we've spent on youth ministers, Christian music, publishing, and media has produced a culture of young Christians who know next to nothing about their own faith except how they feel.
Yeah, oh, Kevin, and this worries me, I must say, so much. I see these statistics from Barna, for example, about the number of Christian kids who, once they leave high school, leave home, go out to college, never darken the doorway of a church again. They've already lost their faith while in that high school youth group. But so long as they're still under mom and dad's tutelage at home, they continue to go through the motions, they attend the youth group, but once they go off to college, they jettison it, they abandon it. And I do find it bewildering when I think of all of the effort that's been invested in Christian music and worship and Christian activities for young people and all of the sorts of things that we've done to make our churches relevant and attractive to teenagers, that it doesn't seem to be producing the sort of lasting fruit that one would want to expect. And so I do think that we desperately need to disciple high schoolers in the life of the mind, to train them what they believe and to train them how to defend what they believe. So again, that is a problem that he's right about, that we have got to do better on.
He says there are three kinds of evangelical churches today: consumer-driven megachurches, dying churches, and new churches whose future is fragile. Denominations will shrink, even vanish, while fewer and fewer evangelical churches will survive and thrive. Now, he puts a period right there. I don't disagree with the fact that there are many, many consumer-driven mega churches, so-called seeker churches, seeker-sensitive, seeker-driven churches. There are a bunch of those. Dying churches, there are some denominations, some traditional denominations that are just, their members are evacuating. But then he says, and new churches whose future is fragile.
There isn't any evidence there, is there, that he gives?
Not really.
The dying churches tend not to be the evangelical churches. These tend to be these old mainline denominations that have adopted liberal Protestantism. And those are bleeding members. But it's no wonder. Why get up in the dark and the cold on Sunday morning to go to some church service that just preaches a sort of humanism? You don't need God and Christ to be a good humanist and live a decent life. So it's no wonder that those kind of churches are losing members. And I think as these mainline churches have declined, traditional Protestantism has lost its grip on American culture, and American culture has become more secularized. The challenge will be whether this precipitous decline in the mainline denominations can be offset by the growth of evangelical churches, which are becoming increasingly prominent, I think, in our American culture. And there needs to be somewhere these lines need to cross so that the decline is offset by the increase in evangelical churches. And I simply disagree with them that all of these mega churches are consumer-driven, superficial churches. Some are, but certainly not all of them. And so there, I think he's overly pessimistic. I think that there's hope for the revival of the mind in the church. And I do see this going on, Kevin. I noticed it in this article. He takes no cognizance whatsoever. He seems utterly unaware of the revolution that has been going on in Christian philosophy over the last 40 years and how this is beginning to trickle down to popular culture in the church through popularizers like Lee Strobel and Ravi Zacharias and others. This intellectual material is beginning to trickle down out of the academy into the man in the pew. And I find tremendous grassroots interest among lay people in our churches in being trained in the defense of the faith. They're hungry for it. They want it. And if this revolution can continue to grow and be fostered, that gives grounds for optimism that this internal collapse that he describes won't happen. But I do think, or I do fear, that it may be a race against time. Will the collapse occur more rapidly than the resurgence in apologetics and doctrine? And I just pray and hope that the latter will grow more rapidly than the collapse occurs.
Me too. I'll give you an observation here, Bill. I see a light at the end of the tunnel. A lot of people are complaining about consumer-driven megachurches and things like that. You know, I've noticed in my observations of looking at these, what used to be called seeker-driven churches. All churches should be seeker-sensitive. Mm-hmm. Seekers, you know, seek and you shall find. Absolutely, we should be all about seekers. But I think that a lot of these churches, the past 15 years, we have really tried to be more relevant, throw off maybe some baggage that didn't need to be there, and be perhaps a little more what church needs to be to reach out to the world, reach out to the secular world. There's been a growing process in the last 15 years to make sure that all of this consumerism and so on is tempered with worship and with good teaching and so on. So I'm seeing some signs of that.
Some self-correction.
I'm seeing some self-correction.
Yeah. Now, look, you know, that happened at Willow Creek, didn't it?
Of course it did. It really did. And we've had to learn our lesson. See, we went through a transition. Look, guys, we've got to be more relevant. We've got to be more accepting. We've got to welcome people in. We've got to let our own people express themselves in the arts and things. We have a lot of talented people in the pews. Let's put them to work for the glory of God and so on. So there, I do see a self-correction. And I pray as well that race against time, that correction will continue. He says, despite some very successful developments in the past 25 years, Christian education has not produced a product that can withstand the rising tide of secularism.
Yeah, now see there, that's where I wonder, is he aware of what's happening in Christian philosophy? And or maybe, now here, see where I wonder, I have my own self-doubt, Kevin, I think, is the fact that I am so involved in Christian philosophy causing me to be myopic and think that this is a bigger influence than it really is, sort of like holding your thumb right in front of your nose and it looks as big as a skyscraper. Maybe I'm overestimating the impact of Christian philosophy, but I hope not. And my hope is that as this revolution continues, that more and more we'll impact the secular university with Christian philosophers in all disciplines, and that this will have an increasingly positive leavening effect upon Christian education and our culture. So I'm not sure this fellow's really in touch with what's happening in Christian education.
Okay. And as we wrap up today, just a couple of points, some of his observations as well. For one thing, he expects the emergent church, so-called, that everybody's talking about these days, he does think that will diminish.
Yes.
And have a tendency to go away.
I think he's right.
He's not saying this, but I think, and I think that you think, that the emerging church has misdiagnosed the so-called widespread postmodernism, and it's not the bugaboo we thought it was, and they've gone that direction and built a foundation of sand, and then they're so nebulous. We could get into the emerging church, but I'm just telling you that he's saying that they're going to go away. But he hopes that a better evangelicalism will arise. He says, we don't need a bailout. Much of it needs a funeral. You know, he says that our children are not going to be as confident in the Bible as we are. Even in areas where evangelicals imagine themselves strong, like the Bible Belt, we will find a great inability to pass on to our children a vital evangelical confidence in the Bible.
I noticed he seemed to be very much in favor of home churches emerging as the sort of new vital Christianity, which I suspect is, again, just sort of his proclivity personally. I don't see any reason to think that that's going to characterize church life in general in the United States. So I think that there probably it does reflect some of the personal preferences of the author.
It says Michael Spencer is a writer and communicator living and working in a Christian community in Kentucky. He describes himself as a post-evangelical Reformation Christian in search of a Jesus-shaped spirituality. Internetmonk.com. So yes, home churches, home cells, Christian community. I think it's an attempt to look more like the Book of Acts or the New Testament Christian. Nothing wrong with that. Home churches, some of the churches I've noticed are having a hard time getting people into these home cells as the paradigm kind of shifts toward that. Rather than in your traditional Sunday school, get together on Sunday morning in your Sunday school class, home cells are developing. And yet some pastors are saying, well, that's a good New Testament thing, but it disconnects them from the church.
Yeah. I don't see any reason to think that within the wider context of a church group or a church community, that you can't have these small groups that add for additional intimacy and connection with a small group of people, but they don't need to be divorced from the larger context. And this larger church will have great advantages to impacting culture and society. I lived in France for some time with my wife, and I have to say, attending these small, little, insular churches can be tremendously depressing because you don't have things like great music, for example, that you will get in a church like we currently attend, where we have a wonderful choir, a full orchestra. I appreciate great music, and you won't have that when you have eight people sitting around the living room, you know, trying to sing choruses together. You won't have the same talents that can be exercised in the context of a large body. So there are tremendous advantages to being in part of a larger group and then having your smaller, intimate group within the context of the larger group. So while there are certain things that this fellow says that I think are warnings that are definitely to be heeded, good admonitions, I don't think we need to be as pessimistic as he is, nor to necessarily follow all of the advice that he gives.
Well, thank you so much for spending some time with us on Reasonable Faith with William Lane Craig. This podcast is available at reasonablefaith.org, as well as a wealth of audio, video, and written materials from Dr. William Lane Craig, an interactive forum, and a question and answer section that is really popular. People all over the world have benefited from the insights of Dr. Craig, and we invite you to browse our resources at reasonablefaith.org. When you give to Reasonable Faith or purchase our resources, you help us expand into more media and speaking events all over the world. If you appreciate these topics and this ministry, please consider being a part of us with your financial gifts. For more information, go to reasonablefaith.org. I'm Kevin Harris. Join us again for Reasonable Faith with Dr. William Lane Craig.